This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Overall, it's a pretty small percentage of LA's consumption. It's kind of an every little helps idea as far as evaporation. The real issue, the reason LA had to do this was for water quality.
Did you eat any stone fruit this summer? What about that superfood, broccoli? Will that make it into the dinner menu this week? Or perhaps there's a tasty salad in your lunch plans. If any of these nutritious foods are a regular part of your diet, then you're probably pretty dependent on California. So it might matter to you that we're 4 years into what some scientists are calling California's worst drought in 1,200 years. What's going to happen with the drought in California is a national concern, not only because it's the most populous state, but because California accounts for the majority of fruits, vegetables, and nuts produced in the U.S. This week on Sea Change Radio, we're talking about the California drought, getting an update on weather-related aspects, and finding out about an innovation designed to help. First, we talk to Anthony Artusa, a meteorologist from the National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center. He gives us a sense of what to expect from the current El Niño year and what it may or may not mean to California long term. Then we talk to Peter Brewitt, who recently wrote about the millions of plastic shade balls being used in LA's main reservoir to try to slow evaporation. Might this potentially controversial innovation provide a lasting solution? Find out next on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Anthony Artusa. He's a meteorologist with the Climate Prediction Center. Anthony, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
So why don't you first tell us what an El Niño is and why it's important for the Western drought that we're suffering from here in the United States right now?
The El Niño is a term that was developed about 30 or 40 years ago. It refers to the little child, and it's basically a reference around Christmas time to the Christ child. What happens during an El Niño is that the sea surface temperatures in the East Central Pacific are warmer than normal, and a lot of this heat that's stored in the ocean, especially if you have a lot of heat energy at depth, can then be transferred to the atmosphere and can move downstream across the United States and having an impact not only on the United States, but also around the globe in the tropics.
So we usually will see increased rainfall with an El Niño, correct?
That's correct. Usually in California during January, February, and March, during that three-month season, is when the precipitation with El Niño typically will reach its furthest north across the state. That's in a classic El Niño, or a typical one. No two El Niños are ever exactly alike, but they often have common characteristics. For example, you have the warmer than usual sea surface temperatures. You have a stronger subtropical jet across the southern part of California, and an increase of precipitation across the state.
And when do we know we're actually having one? Is it just when it's rained for X amount of days, or is this a unique occurrence that meteorologists can say, okay, now we're officially having an El Niño?
Actually, it's a combination of some atmospheric and oceanic conditions. Once these conditions are met, we have what we term either an El Niño or a La Niña. At the present time, the conditions are in place for an El Niño, so we have an El Niño in progress at this time, and we think that the El Niño will strengthen throughout the fall and probably reach its peak sometime in the late fall, perhaps early winter. then we think it will eventually wind down. It will probably be gone by sometime in the spring. So we already are in the El Nino. Some of the impacts of the El Nino will show up toward the cold season.
So the actual El Nino that we're in is more of a water temperature and atmospheric shift. Is that fair to say?
Yes, to some degree. The ocean is noticeably warmer, and especially in the equatorial Pacific, in the central and in the eastern equatorial Pacific, and not only at the surface but at depth. And in terms of the atmosphere, there are changes in the precipitation patterns and also in upper level and lower level winds. So this is how we can tell if we have an El Nino or a La Nina when we consider both the atmosphere and the ocean.
And with climate change, can we expect to have more El Ninos?
That's a tricky call. That's a hard one to answer because normally with an El Nino, one of the precursors or the conditions that you need is for something to change in the tropics. Normally, in the low latitudes, you have the trade winds, which are blowing from, let's say, the east or northeast across the Pacific. And what this does is it tends to kind of push all this warmer surface water into the western tropical Pacific and tends to hold it there. Now, if all of a sudden these sustained trade winds, if they were to weaken, all that warmer water that's in the western Pacific can now slosh eastward. And that has some implications for the thermocline in the ocean and also for the atmospheric patterns for the U.S. But it is tied to the strength of the trade winds, also the direction, whether it's easterly or westerly. And also just throughout the last couple of years, how much heat energy has accumulated within the tropics. It takes an El Nino to take that heat energy in the western part of the Pacific and to push it eastward towards the United States.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Anthony Artusa. He's a meteorologist for the Climate Prediction Center. So when we're looking back at this exceptional drought over the last 4 years or so, Anthony, how can an El Nino season change? Will it be able to move the needle, so to speak, enough to get us out of this drought, or is it just going to be a drop in the bucket?
Well, of course, it all depends on the strength of the El Nino, and we do think it will be a strong one throughout the late fall and early winter months. Normally, you would get a stronger jet stream across the southern tier of the United States. The jet stream is normally accompanied by storms and precipitation patterns. So this should help to, improve the drought conditions across California. Again, if this turns out to be what we think will be a strong El Nino. There are some questions, though. It's hard to say whether or not it'll be a real solid drought buster. At this time, we don't really expect it. Because it depends on a few things. For one, it depends exactly where the heaviest rain falls. And as you know, most of the reservoirs are in the central and northern part of the state. And with El Nino, you tend to get most of the precipitation focused toward the south. So it depends on how much rain you get. And very importantly for California, it depends how much precipitation falls in the form of snow across the Sierras and in the north.
That was my next question, actually. I was curious, because this precipitation is generated by warmer water, that doesn't necessarily mean that the storms would be warmer storms. Would this mean possibly rain in the Sierra?
That is possible, because I think it was within the past couple of years that California had some areas that had quite a bit of rain, but most of it was warm enough to be rain and not snow. So rain is something that can be used sort of here and now. But the snow cover is very important, because, especially in the higher elevations, because it melts slowly throughout the spring season and the summer, the early summer, So that's what's able to constantly provide water for much of the state.
Should this be something that ski resort owners are optimistic about, the El Nino prediction?
I would think yes. To some degree, they should be expecting, you know, some relief from the current drought conditions, especially if they can get enough, if it's cold enough to get some of the snow as opposed to the rain. Normally with El Nino, this is your big chance in California to get precipitation. The big question is whether or not it'll be rain or snow. If the typical scenario occurs where you have rain for the lower elevations and snow for the higher elevations, like in the Sierras, then yes, that should be a boon to the ski, you know, businesses and stuff in the state. So at least with an El Nino, you have a chance for more snow.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Anthony Artusa. He's a meteorologist for the Climate Prediction Center. So, Anthony, how long have you been a meteorologist, if I can ask?
I've been a meteorologist almost 30 years with the government.
And how has climate change affected your job, if at all?
I would say that for the last few decades, I think that what we have done was focused mainly on North America. We haven't really looked at the globe, although certain portions of my branch do look at weather conditions across the globe. But where we are here in the operations area, we tend to focus mostly on the 50 United States. And that's been where the focus has been. We have noticed a gradual warming trend, although there are, you know, fluctuations in that. Sometimes it's more pronounced than other times.
I just noticed that July was the hottest on record in global history.
I have heard of that as well. I heard about that earlier today during the call. It's something that, again, here we don't really focus too much on because we're mostly focused on the United States. A lot will depend on the quality of the observations around the globe. But there does seem to be a trend where it has been, you know, there has been some warming. So it is something that we need to look at.
He's a meteorologist for the Climate Prediction Center, Anthony Artusa. Anthony, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Peter Brewitt. He is an environmental studies professor at Wofford College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and writes about the environment. Peter, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently penned a piece for Orion about shade balls, which kind of went viral. First, why don't you tell us what this seemingly wacky solution is all about?
Sure. Well, the story begins, I suppose, with the EPA requiring finished water reservoirs. That's reservoirs where the water is supposed to go directly to your tap. to be covered, mostly for water quality purposes. As water absorbs UV light and have chemical reactions that can cause contamination. As a kind of a side note, it also, of course, would tamp down on some evaporation, which is something that everybody with an open water source tries to fight. So I guess the most obvious thing you'd do would be to kind of put a big tarp over it or bury it or something like that. But what the Los Angeles did was took a look at the costs and had the idea of, instead of putting a plastic tarp or digging an aquifer of some kind, to cover the top of the reservoir with black plastic balls, which would do the same trick in terms of absorbing UV light and tamping down an evaporation for much less money.
And you have to kind of see this to believe it. Did you get a chance to check these out in the Los Angeles reservoir where the first installation has taken place?
The videos have been all over the place, so I've gotten to see those, and they are indeed quite the spectacle. LA's actually been doing this for the last few years. The videos that popped up all over Facebook this month are of, as far as I can tell, kind of the last stage of doing this. It's something that I kind of would like to go and see in person, but living across the country now, it's not quite a good enough reason to go to LA.
And the first thing that shouted out at me is plastic. We always hear about plastic being not something that you want your kids to eat out of too often, and that there's lots of harmful residue coming from plastic. These are apparently BPH or BPA free plastic balls that are being floated into the reservoir. But is that good enough? I've also read some reports that it's not just BPA or BPH that's the problem. It's more insidious.
Well, I thought that myself. And in fact, when I first saw these things, I kind of had the same reaction where I thought, that sounds stupid. And honestly, kind of expecting to savage the idea in my column. Once I looked into it, it seems like it's really the least bad option, which a lot of the time is what good environmental infrastructural decisions are about. If you were to put a tarp over, it would probably be plastic as well. Some sort of natural fiber would be more likely to rot or blow away or break down sooner. And a lot of the other kind of bigger ideas of, digging some sort of underground aquifer and covering it with land would be very, very expensive. So it seems like in balance, this works pretty well. The other thing to bear in mind with that is, I'm not going to pretend to be a chemist. There are a lot of different kinds of plastic, and we use plastic more or less constantly in our lives, plastic water bottles and so on. While it's reasonable to be skeptical of plastic, and especially in kind of a macro sense, it's not a very sustainable thing to produce, these balls seem like they're about as safe a substance as you could hope for.
And give us an idea of how much these shade balls could actually help squelch evaporation. How much water could they ultimately save in a reservoir like the Los Angeles Reservoir, which is 175 acres of fresh water?
The number that they're throwing out there is 300 million gallons. I don't see any particular reason to doubt that. It's important to keep in mind when we talk about numbers like that, that sounds like a great big number. I mean, you'd love to have $300 million. But overall, it's a pretty small percentage of LA's consumption. Really, it's kind of an every little helps idea as far as evaporation. The real issue, the reason LA had to do this, was for water quality.
The total cost of the program is $34 million, 36 cents a ball. But is there any kind of cost-benefit analysis that you were given?
I haven't seen cost-benefit analysis in terms of the cost of the water. As I'm sure you know, water costs in California are viciously complicated. And so if we were to replace that water with relatively cheap agricultural water, historically cheap at least, then it would be a pretty different thing than figuring out how much Los Angeles has to pay for it. I think the thing to bear in mind with tallying up costs here is the other options for covering the reservoir. The number that they, the savings that they give is $250 million. And while that presumably is LA making its case, at the same time, I don't see any particular reason to doubt that. I mean, they say that installing covers would cost $300 million. So that's I think, the best way to think about it.
And is this an idea, this shade balls concept, Peter, that California is planning to roll out into other reservoirs around the state?
That's a good question. I've wondered that. It would really be a decision to be made municipality by municipality or manager by manager. So I wonder if San Francisco might try and do the same thing, but I have not heard any such suggestion. I don't see why not. If it's a reservoir that has a lot of recreational use or fishing or something like that, then it might be a different story. But I could see another city deciding to do the same kind of thing.
And tell us a little bit about the substance that makes these shade balls black. Carbon black is the substance. It's pretty interesting.
As far as I can see, it's a pigment that's food safe, as well as being as good as possible at absorbing UV light, which is the real job for these balls. That's something people have wondered about, is why not use lighter colored balls to keep the water cooler, but the absorption of the light is the key there, and that's what carbon black does.
The video I've seen is these trucks just dumping these millions of balls. I guess in there's 96 million balls in this one reservoir. How are they going to get them all out?
Well, I've wondered that myself. And that was kind of one of my first concerns, was it seems like these balls have become litter pretty quickly, but in fact, it doesn't seem like they will. First of all, each ball has a little bit of water in it, so it's ballasted. It's not likely to blow away in the wind. And we have really good screening technology in Western waterways right now. So it would be pretty easy to contain the balls in the reservoir and keep them from flowing in through any outlets. Having said that, I have not seen any statements from Los Angeles about what they're going to do with the balls. I mean, the assumption is that they'll last a decade or two, and I would expect that between now and then, there will be different regulations on water that will eventually force the decision. Walk, talk, and act like me. It just might be the next best thing, but not quite me. I'm Slim Shady, yes, I'm the real Shady. All you other Slim Shadys are just imitating. So won't the real Slim Shady please stand up? Please stand up. Please stand up. Cause I'm Slim Shady, yes, I'm the real Shady. All you other Slim Shadys are just imitating. So won't the real Slim Shady please stand up? Please stand up. Please stand up. I'm like a head trip to listen to. Cause I'm only giving you things you joke about with your friends inside your living room. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to environmental writer Peter Brewitt. So, Peter, you've written several different water and drought-related pieces recently for Orion Magazine. Maybe you can give us a summary of those pieces, highlighting other innovative ways to fight the drought.
Sure. Well, it's a really difficult thing to do on a large scale, so there are a lot of creative solutions kind of from the bottom up. One of the things that I think is most promising is people turning their lawns over to native vegetation. If you try to make a lawn such as if you lived still in Kentucky or in England, then in California, that's just going to soak up water. But nowadays, people are going with xeriscaping, xeriscaping, which is putting in the kind of chaparral or desert plants, arid native plants that would naturally grow in the California climate. So we're seeing programs that are encouraging people to do that up and down the state. At the same time, if you only have so much water in a city, you have to figure out how to make it work as hard as it possibly can. So one of the things that I think we're starting to see, and that I expect that we're going to see in the relatively near future, is the increased use of what they call black water, which is water that's gone through your sewage system that then goes back into the drinking supply after, of course, being properly treated. Now, this is the kind of thing that happens eventually anyway. I mean, all water that goes through a toilet eventually ends up back in the global water system and will be drunk by somebody. What we're trying to do now is figure out technologies to safely and quickly speed that up so that water that gets contaminated by human waste is safe to drink quickly again.
Why are we filling up our toilets with fresh water?
Basically, the issue is infrastructure. The cities have all set up their piping systems and their water systems usually long ago. We're not building very many cities from scratch. And so if you've got water flowing into the toilet from a particular source, then it's relatively expensive initially to change that around. I would expect that we'll see household uses, like we're already seeing with gray water relatively commonly, to where black water gets rid back into toilets and so on. At the same time, it does require a certain amount of treatment. You don't want the toilet water in your tank to smell like sewage. So figuring out that system is going to take some technological advancement, but there are people working on it.
Well, I hope so. It's one of those things that makes me scratch my head as we see us using perfectly potable water for just flushing it away for our waste. But this infrastructure was created in a time when water was not considered a scarcity like it is now.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the kind of constant struggles with the environment is dealing with yesterday's problems. And it's hard to blame our forefathers, I guess, for the decisions they made. They didn't have the kind of technology or cultural understanding that we do. But nonetheless, if we're trying to reimagine our infrastructure, we have to do it on top of stuff that they've already done. So that's actually something that we're seeing in some developing countries, is places that didn't have old infrastructure building new more or less from scratch. I mean, places that didn't have, this is different from water, but that didn't have landlines and telephone poles, never having to build the kind of massive network of telephone poles that we have in this country, because everybody went straight from no telephone to cell phones. That's the kind of challenge that we don't get to take up in this country. We have to figure out how to deal with the old stuff as well as implementing the new.
You can read his work in Orion Magazine. Peter Brewitt. Peter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Budos Band, Grateful Dead, and Eminem.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.